We've now seen more pain and more horror and more grief in this courtroom than any of you would have thought possible. That's how attorneys for convicted Boston Marathon bomber Zahar Tzenayev opened as they began their defense in the sentencing phase of the death penalty trial against him. Their goal now is to shift the focus from all that pain and horror to put Tzenayev's crimes into the context of his life story and his psyche, all in an effort to convince just one juror that he deserves life in prison instead of death. It's day 23, and from the Moakley Federal Courthouse, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. For WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
So, Kevin, up stepped the quiet man on a relatively quiet defense team, David Brook. He was earnest. He was respectful. I thought he was quite impressive.
He was professorial, and that's because David is a professor, but he also knows his stuff. And as much as some people might have expected Judy Clark to lead this off, I have no doubt that Judy Clark will give the closing statement for the defense, probably in 2 weeks' time.
Along with the rest of the defense team, he's been very respectful of the witnesses, many of whom were not cross-examined. I think they've been direct with the jurors. They promised the jurors. They said that they would. They were not shirking Zahar's responsibilities. But here he is faced with the overwhelming conviction, and he says to them, and he knows that they need to be addressed as to the reality of what happened, and he says, "The man who conceived, planned, and led these crimes is beyond our power. Only the 19-year-old younger brother is left." And then, frankly, he says to them, "There is no evening of the scales, no point in trying to hurt him as he hurt, because it can't be done. If you sentence him to life without parole, it will be punishment that will protect society."
Yeah, that whole opening statement struck me, David, is this plea. It was planting a seed that they will continue to grow over the next 2 weeks. And that seed that they hope will grow is the idea that if you really want to punish Zahar Tzenayev, sentence him to the Supermax prison in Colorado, a place that its former warden once called a clean version of hell. Basically, the defense strategy is this: hell in a cell is preferable to dead in a bed.
I was struck by the photo they introduced, the first photo I believe they introduced, of the landscape in wintertime in Colorado, in Florence, Colorado, the mountains in the background. And I've been there and I've seen it. It looked like Siberia.
Yes.
It looked severely cold. And David Brook starts with a statement: "This is where the government keeps other terrorists who used to be famous and aren't anymore."
I thought the snow, the way it sort of encompassed the whole facility, it was almost like a blanket. And he was suggesting that the screams of the wretched souls in that place would be muffled by this snow. No one will ever hear them again. It was something he repeated. It's not that you were just sentencing him to this place. He will never be heard from again. That's the bargain they're offering the jurors. Send him to this place and we'll never speak his name again.
This is stark, and to hear it from
his lawyers,
his own attorneys, is starker still. As Tzenayev looks on, his attorney says to the jurors, "He can never hurt any more or be heard from again. He goes there and he's forgotten. No spotlight, no martyrdom, there'll be no autobiography, no nothing."
I had to think, what was Tzenayev thinking while his own lawyers were saying this? But obviously, he signed up to the program. They're his lawyers. He hasn't asked to get rid of them yet. They were basically asking the jurors to send him to the worst place in the United States, the worst 7 by 12 feet space in the United States.
Well, it's interesting because your paper, the Boston Globe, had a story in the Sunday paper on the front pages about ADX, otherwise known as Supermax. If you want to get a little better sense of it, consider this. The inmates are confined to their cells for 23 hours a day. They're allowed 3 showers a week. It's surrounded by mountains.
You don't see the mountains.
The only thing you see of the sky is if you go into the recreation area. And even that view is framed by barbed wire.
It seemed that during the guilt phase of the trial, the prosecution was obsessed with that Islamic flag in Zahar Tzenayev's bedroom. And now the defense is obsessed with the place it wants to make the bedroom for him for the rest of his life.
But I think it comes off as effective. Here it is. you cannot undo what he did.
Mm-hmm.
The main person involved in this, and nobody really questions that Tamerlan was
the leadership role.
Was the
no
lead.
Question.
Yeah, you can't get to him, but here's what you can do to this kid. He won't come out. You won't hear from him.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be safeguarded. It will be over, and he goes away forever.
And Brooke repeated that theme that we've heard from the defense, less so in the first phase of the trial because they didn't dispute much, is that if not for Tamerlan, Jahar Tsarnaev wouldn't be here. Now, whether the jury believes that is might be the determining factor of whether they decide to spare his life. But in fact, as soon as the witnesses started coming up, I don't think there was a witness that mentioned Jahar in any kind of context, saying that they didn't know him, or one witness played soccer with him. But it was all about Tamerlan. This is going to be about Tamerlan. The defense is going to talk in terms of incriminating information. They're going to talk almost exclusively about Tamerlan, and that Jahar is almost an afterthought.
Well, I think we are going to get a social history mm-hmm. of Jahar Tsarnaev.
Right.
And we have people that are going to talk about life histories. Of the eight witnesses today, none of them we would call major witnesses, and yet each in their own way are adding something. Well, some of them to Tamerlan,
they
as to what kind of a character the dead older brother is. But I thought, for instance, that Judith Russell, the mother-in-law of Tamerlan, was fascinating, talking about the son-in-law from hell.
No, I thought she was terrific, but we can't say for sure, but it looks to me that what the defense is going to do is lay out all these people who knew Tamerlan, and he's going to come across as this social misfit, this fundamentalist person who just turned and tried to turn everybody around him toward this worldview of which Islamic people were being persecuted across the world, and he was obsessed with it. And then we're going to contrast that the way people will start describing Jahar as just this average kid, this kid that was very sociably engaged. He had lots of friends. He wasn't talking about extreme forms of religion or anything like that. He was playing sports. He played soccer. He was the captain of the wrestling team. The juxtaposition of these two brothers is going to be so stark by the time the defense finishes this.
I thought it was just intriguing to listen to the mother-in-law, knowing that her daughter, a non-Muslim, who suddenly meets somebody who doesn't want to meet the parents,
mm-hmm.
who is difficult at best, that she recognizes it's a bad choice. And in fact, he hasn't been really moved by the religion to the point where he is the true zealous believer at that point. It's fascinating to see.
But, you know, they also showed, David, they showed Katie Russell, and that's they called her Katie. That's what she was
the
known.
Daughter, who was
the
married.
Daughter,
yes.
Who married. She was this all-American, ordinary, average American girl, and she fell under the sway of this kid, and suddenly she starts covering up. She starts wearing a hijab. She becomes a follower of Islam. So, obviously, the jury's sitting there, and the defense wants them to believe. If he could take this all-American girl from Rhode Island, from a very successful family, dad's a doctor, mom's a nurse, and get her to convert to Islam, why wouldn't you believe that he could take his own little brother and convert him to his extremist ways?
Bill Weinreb, the prosecutor, made a mistake, I thought, because he wanted to knock down the idea that Tamerlan was charismatic. And he said to one of the witnesses, so he no charisma there. Correction. Yes.
Yes.
He was a charmer.
He was. And I think, you know, that's why I think the example that Catherine Russell's mother testified to was very important for the defense, because it talked about the powers of persuasion that Tamerlan had. He was sort of a failure in so many other things that he did, but he did have charisma. He was able to get, you know, a thoroughly Americanized girl from an upper middle class background to basically turn her back on everything she had.
Separate.
And go his way. And obviously, Catherine Russell wearing a hijab and converting to Islam is a lot different than what he's supposed to have done with the younger brother. But it does talk about the same powers of persuasion and isolation.
Judith Russell was clear on this, and I thought what she said was commendable. You know, we don't have any problems with Islam.
It wasn't the problem with that he was converting her to Islam. The problem she had as a mother is that he wasn't working. He was doing all his, you know, his internet searches, doing everything. Catherine's out there supporting the family.
And
even
he went
after
off,
she had a child.
Went off to Russia for 6 months. And by the way, the defense was clear on one thing in that opening statement. They say he went to Russia, into the woods of Dagestan, to plan jihad.
Right.
We are going to get, and this Brooke made a point of this, mm-hmm. to context. What's intriguing, they're starting on the mother, mm-hmm. Zubaydat. And he describes in the opening that you're going to hear more about her, but she is over the top, loud, self-aggrandizing. Then he tells the story, of course, Zubeidat is not Chechen. She's close to Chechen, but she isn't, was not embraced. In fact, was rejected by her husband's family. They talk about that she's alienated herself from the community. And then, this is important, she worships her eldest son, Tamerlan. He's the one. He's failing miserably. And as all of this is going on, she starts dressing in black. The older son is starting to turn to the religion. She's starting to turn to the religion. And at one point, Bruck uses this phrase, maternal delusion. So I think this is fascinating, and the jury seem interested in it.
Yeah, it is. And it seems to me the two lead characters we're going to see in this are going to be Tamerlan and Zubeidat, the mother. And they're going to be portrayed as these really, you know, dominant figures and characters in this family, and the Jahar is sort of hopelessly caught between the sway of a mother who's really lost it and a brother who he looks up to. And they said not just for cultural reasons, but what was peculiar to that family, because the father, Anzor, had a breakdown. He had a head injury. He had what the defense described a mental illness, and that so by default, Tamerlan became the man of the household, the father of the household. So in some respects, he wasn't just an older brother at this point. He was the paternal figure.
Somewhere along the line, Bruck says that Jahar suddenly goes into an alternate reality, and he's suggesting that is where he picks up radical ideas, the religion, and off we go.
And Bruck said there is going to be some background provided from a Princeton professor who really understands the Chechen people, that sort of Chechen history lesson, which I'm assuming will be fairly brief, but it's going to put into, as you said, David, context. The context of how the Tsarnaevs found themselves in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the first place. And then we get to the sort of breakdown, the complete breakdown, the implosion of that family, of the parents moving back to Dagestan, of Jahar being left here with the older brother as the only older influence in his life. We're all getting back to, please sentence this kid to life. Don't kill him because he was in a crazy household surrounded by irresponsible, crazy people.
The defense, I thought, had a good day, but certainly, to quote Kevin Cullen, it's a Sisyphean challenge.
Glad you said that.
This is the end of day 23. Join us again tomorrow as the defense continues to present mitigating factors. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse, this is Finish Line inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. For WBUR, I'm David Boyer.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Finish Line inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial is a co-production of WBUR and the Boston Globe. New episodes of the podcast will be released multiple times a week throughout the trial after court lets out for the day. You can listen at WBUR.org and at bostonglobe.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where new episodes will appear as soon as they're released. Go to the podcast section of iTunes and search Finish Line to subscribe. Thanks for listening.